Which is good. I mean, I'm working on it. Yeah. It's a work in progress.
To say that's better than what I have to offer. Beautiful.
A nice musical introduction.
Yeah, exactly. So today is the last time of this 2-week series, and I'm going to spend most of it as open-ended as I can get it for you, for just questions and thoughts that you'd like to think. Or ask relative to the mix of documents that we've been studying for however long that you have been studying in these 2 weeks. Some of you have been here for the whole time and some of you haven't. I think out of these sessions, I told you all about the trash dump in Egypt. Did I tell you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else know about the Oxyrhynchus trash dump in Egypt that I told you about? Some of you about, I think it was mostly outside. So Oxyrhynchus is the name of an ancient city in Egypt. It's actually also the name of the place of a modern city in Egypt, in central Egypt. And there were some indications in the 1870s that probably that this ancient city existed, but there was already a city on top of it. But they were finding things down when people would dig down for wells and the like, and they concluded that it was Oxford and Cambridge concluded that this was worth an archaeological excavation. And so from 1880 to 1890, they sponsored a 10-year excavation. They didn't destroy the current Egyptian city at that time, but what happened was they noticed that the trash dump of the ancient city was happily outside the ancient city. And they spent their entire 10 years digging up the trash dump of Oxyrhynchus as an ancient Greco-Romanized Egyptian city, because at that time the Oxyrhynchus was built. It was built basically by the Romans as a part of their conquering of Egypt. Well, so you know, you find everything in a trash dump. We kind of know around here some of this. But the really amazing thing is how much papyrus they found. They just found scads and scads of papyrus, that is, written things. Some of them were like bills from the grocery store, and some of them were philosophy. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the situation in terms of early Christian texts. But here's the really wild thing. As Europeans were apt to do in those days, at the end of their 10 years, they packed everything up that they had found and took it back to England to study. It took them 3 years to get everything back. It was a whole bunch of trash, ancient trash. And when they got back in the mid-1890s, they decided that they would, because there was so much, so they would just appoint a 10-person work team that would go through all of this. And So that 10-person work team was really basically ongoing. In other words, some people dropped the team and others were brought on. That team is still working. It started in 1895. It's still working. And they've gotten through 5% of what they brought back. In that 5%, they've discovered two gospels that we never knew about. And one of the most amazing things is the Nagamani people that we're talking about, we've been talking about, the Nagamani jar, that that one of the Nagamani finds is the Gospel of Thomas, probably the most famous of the newly discovered Gospels. Gospel of Thomas is in Coptic in the Nagamani jar. But in Oxyrhynchus, recently people have had, you know, displayed a bunch of the pieces of papyrus that they've been sorting through in England. And now they've discovered that, because they now know what the Gospel of Thomas is, that actually a bunch of the trash is our little pieces of the Gospel of Thomas in another language, in Greek. So, I guess, well, so they found Nagamani in 1945, right? Before that, we thought there was a Gospel of Thomas, but we didn't know what it was. But then we had the whole thing. Now we know that it wasn't only existing, but that it was so popular that it was translated into multiple languages by the second century. So I like to tell this story just as Jeff and I over the weekend were talking. He said, "So, think there are any more things to discover?" And that's kind of my answer is, just in Oxford and Cambridge, there's 95% of the trash from that ancient trash dump that they haven't gone through. And when they went through 5%, they found two more gospels. Karen King, who we've been alluding to, a professor at Harvard, she estimates that the writings from the first two centuries of the Christ movement that we have, probably between 15 and 20% of what was written. The really interesting thing for us, and then I would say the spiritually exciting thing, is that basically we're entering a period in which a whole bunch of Western, that is American and European, shall we say, archaeological robbers, have in the basements of their museums and universities have stuff from North Africa that they brought back and haven't yet even, they don't have teams for. So, for instance, the two institutions that I teach for, Columbia University and Union Theological Seminary, both of them have, we know that they have things from the ancient world that were brought to them and given to them, or brought back by faculty members, which haven't even been unpacked. So as we kind of come to a conclusion of this time together, which we've been able to look at about six different ancient documents that relate in one way or another to the Gospel of John. That's kind of the perspective that is laid out for us in terms of possibilities of other things emerging. What I said, yes, Robin.
I hope this isn't a distraction, but no. How does something end up being considered a gospel versus some other piece of writing?
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I said these are just the kinds of interruptions I'm hoping for today, because my plan is simply to draw you out. As much as possible in terms of questions that can be helpful for your ongoing relationship to these things and feelings that you have. So the word gospel is where how we determine it. That is, if it, and you heard yesterday how contingent titles are. But if it calls itself a gospel, we say, well, okay. But that's I mean, you let me caution you on this, because remember when we got a chance to just see the gospel of truth and read a little bit of it, it is not a story. So in other words, we would think that a gospel is a story of the life of Jesus, because the four books in the Bible are that. What we don't notice is that Paul, in his letters, says that he's writing the gospel, what he calls the gospel. And the word gospel is the Greek for gospel. Trying to write in English here, is euangelion. Anybody notice what that looks like in English?
Evangelism.
Yeah, evangel or evangelism, evangelical, and something like that. This is really two Greek words. This word means good. This word, you notice what, and if you just saw that word, you would think?
Angel.
Angel, right? So this is basically news. So actually the word in Greek for angel is not what we think of angels, but a messenger. So this is the good message. So that's what a gospel means, Robbie, is it. And then the other thing to respond to what we were talking about yesterday in terms of how Christianity seems to be in resistance to Rome. The word euangelion in that day basically refers to what Augustus Caesar says he is bringing, the good news. Augustus Caesar himself calls his message to the world, meaning we're all one happy people underneath the violent Roman empire. That's the first use of the word good news, or the most prominent. And so for Paul, who first then uses this word as anti-imperial, he says, no, the good news is the good news of Jesus, who was crucified by the empire. So that's more than you wanted to know. Let's just drop the trash dump for a moment and pray. And what I'd like us to do now is not read anything, but just close our eyes, and I'll lead us in just a little bit of a prayer that will have you doing things too. I'll ask us to remember, eyes closed, the first time we felt the power of the Bible in our lives. This can be an ambivalent power, a power for the good, or a power that seems threatening to you. Just remember the first time you felt the power of the Bible. And then I'd encourage you simply inside yourself to either give thanks for it, if it was a good power, or ask for some healing from it if it was a threatening power. Now I'll ask you to think about one of your favorite books. Remember how much you like it and why. And inside you, give thanks for that one of your favorite books. finally I'll ask us to think about the future of our reading. Let's think for a moment about all of this, all of that which we, online or offline or in book or beyond the book, all that we're yet to read. Notice if that feels like too big an assignment, that feels exciting, or if you have mixed feelings about it. Just first think about reading for the rest of your life, and then notice how you feel about it. And give your feelings to God. Amen. So we have been reading the Gospel of John and then these other five or six books, depending on how we're counting. I'm going to first start with, as you look back on sort of the encounter with the combination of a book that's really famous, the Gospel of John, and these other books that are less known, any things that have been coming up in you that you've been noticing about what this combination of reading is doing to you, both either as an insight, a feeling, or a question. In a minute we'll get to factual questions you have, but let's just for a moment go for kind of whether you've been here for one or two sessions or all nine of them, let's notice what we were, some of the insights or personal questions or thoughts that we've had. Yes, Dan.
I'm trying to kind of flesh out the philosophy of Christianity, taking it a little bit beyond superstition or magic,
yeah,
and really kind of the whole idea of, you know, what is to be Christian, what is good, what is, mm-hmm, like, kind of like the plethora of books on Buddhism,
right,
to find out,
right, right.
It kind of takes this starting, this small kernel that you start with, and really grows it into something more.
So that question is just really alive for you. Have you had any ideas of in response to your own question?
I'm not sure I understand.
So you've been asking your question, have you had any ideas about what your impression from the reading of the last couple of weeks, what it might be?
Mostly just I still have much to read.
Other sort of takes?
Well, I mentioned to you the other day that couple of the things that you've read, especially the stuff that wasn't in John,
right?
But some it was also in John too. The idea that we have the light inside of us, the resurrection is now, and we have this purity and this sort of unhindered relationship with God that exists now. It's not something we have to wait for or get to. And even one of the books, I think it was in the Gospel of Mary, was something about kind of dispelling the idea of original sin, right? That
there's no such thing as sin.
No, yeah, such thing as sin, that we don't have that core of sort of badness inside of us, that instead it's just all goodness and light. And but that brought up for me the question of, well, okay, great, love it, but why do we screw up? Why do we have pain? Why do we hurt each other? Why do we lie? And, you know, all the quote-unquote bad things that we still do every day. So where does that come from, you know? And partly, I guess, a personal question, like, where do I think that comes from? But then also I'm curious, like, where these writers that are saying all this stuff, where do they account? How do they account for that?
Yeah. You know?
That's the question I've been kind of sitting with for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's been resonant for me since our conversation too. I'm going to just sort of field some of these and think a little bit with you a little bit, well, as soon as we get some other things on the table. Yes, Karin.
I think at first these sorts of readings, to me, from kind of like an outside perspective, I feel suspicious. Like I feel like, why are we finding them only, you know, 60, 70 years ago? And like, you know, God had this book that he, you know, put all these people together and they, you know, with his handiwork, he put it together and gave it to us. And why weren't these other things there? And I feel like these old suspicions kind of like creeping up on me. But when I'm reading them, like especially the odes, like that we read, like they make sense to me. Like, yeah, I mean, why not add them? Like, why not add them into the mix? Why not add our own odes? And why not we see them as holy? And
can I respond to that just a
little yes, bit? Please.
I think it's interesting you say that because for me, it's almost the first part of what you said, almost the opposite, because I've always been really suspicious of this idea that like God handed us this book and it's like this is what it is and there's the whole thing and that's all there is to it.
Right.
That has always struck me as like, are you really? Like, that doesn't seem quite right to me. And so for me, like finding, I mean, yes, I do wonder like why now?
Right.
Why not before? But knowing that they've been found and that people who know what they're talking about have authenticated them actually like reassures me, like, aha, see, there were other voices.
Yeah.
There were other ideas. And not that one's better or worse or more valuable, or more holy or less holy than the other, but for me it was kind of reassuring to hear about all these different new books because I've always been suspicious of that.
I feel like I know mine has a lot to do with my upbringing. Like, I grew up in
sure.
an evangelical free church.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible. I mean, I remember going to this youth conference where like the speaker held up the book and like flipped the page and said, "You hear the Holy Spirit?"
Yeah. I remember that too. That happened to me too. Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, I want to think that way that you know that the revelation is ongoing. And doesn't stop. Page 1 of Genesis.
Right. Mm-hmm. But also, if you think about it, like, there's no way that everything would survive for 2,000 years. Like, we don't have everything ever that happened
right.
in the ancient world because, you know, things get lost, things get destroyed, there's fires, there's floods, there's, you know, there's no way that everything that was written at that time could last to the present day. And so the fact that we're still finding things now is not, to me, surprising at all, but it's just, like, really interesting that we now have more things to draw on.
It's like the director's cut.
And thanks, Catherine, for mentioning that. That gives me a chance to repeat what I've been repeating. There's so little evidence, actually, that we have now compared to what we've lost.
Yeah.
That's why I always have to say, those of us who you know give our lives to studying this still are making up a bunch of it because there's so much missing.
Mm-hmm.
Comments kind of also kind of resonate with me because I grew up, you know, being taught that, you know, this, oh, I really shouldn't be considering the denomination of it, but anyway, but the Bible is this divinely inspired thing, and yet as I grew and I learned more about how it's put together, I realized it's a very human production, and so that's, and so learning more about the, you know, how much knowledge we're recovering really kind of adds to it. It makes it more important, you know, a little bit more important than we're learning about.
And I
think, it's actually better for me than it's more.
And I think you were there last Friday when I gave the history of how the New Testament came into being. And contrary to what I thought in Sunday school, it did not fall and hit somebody on the head from the sky. Rather, it took about 500 years to kind of hesitantly be put together.
Yeah. I don't know that we're doing children a favor by teaching it simplistically.
Yeah, really.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel
on that.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I just had to say it.
Yeah.
What did you say? Oana.
I totally went to Oana.
Just like, that's all I can say.
I was
go ahead, Robin.
Oh, I was just going to say, I feel very hopeful having been brought up Catholic, and, you know, which doesn't do Bible study anyway, but I just hate what I know about the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like I have no interest in even reading it. I realize that that's probably fairly limiting. but you know, I guess just I just resonate with what people are saying about this feeling like it opens things up in a way that makes that feels intuitively, you know, much more real to me. Because I guess it's hard when you're inside a system to see it, you know. But I mean, I make fun of the Book of Mormon all the time. But you know, how we present the Bible really that much different from, you know, the Book of Mormon? Just there are important differences,
right?
So this it makes me very hopeful. I particularly like the one the day before yesterday because it was so kind of outrageous and poetic.
The thunder.
Yeah.
Yes, Karen.
I just feel that for me, it's I grew up Catholic in a Irish Catholic church, and then did the fundamental Christian thing, and basically, you know, decided that was that. Okay, that stuff is just kind of too scary for me. And I feel that all in all, what I've been sensing from these documents that have been brought out is that we really do, as a world, need a mother, a presence, some sort of a feminine presence that's loving and nurturing. Mm-hmm. And so it gives me a sense of, maybe it's a little tiny tongue of hope, but a little hope that there's a nurturing God and a loving God for the future, for the next generations. Because that would be, you know, as a woman, that would be my hope.
Yeah.
And so reading these words that do contain that motherly voice, to me, it feels like a somewhat feminine voice. I don't know, that's just a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just am feeling that for the children anyway, and the lost ones, that they do have a comfort. Mm-hmm. So to me, that is coming up.
Thank you. Let me reflect a little bit open-endedly and invite you to reflect with me on some of these really important questions. I've just taken note of, I think, most of them. And just to start with the end, so what is the big picture of Christianity and early Christianity if it's not just contained within the cover of the Bible? And that just to say that it is one of the things that is most exciting for us scholars in the last 40 years as we start processing this. And so, for instance, Karen King has called for the rewriting of the history of early Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And then she adds these several words: without canonical or creedal barriers. In other words, so how did those first several hundred years look if we don't say it doesn't count if it's not in the creed, or if it doesn't count if it's not in the Bible? And I think it's too early for us to know overall, except that I would want to say that actually before these documents hit in the last 60 years, the public's consciousness, what was happening for the study of the Bible is we were beginning to notice how diverse the New Testament itself is. In other words, and we've got a little bit of a picture of that even as we studied John. So for instance, when we went through the birth of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we noticed they were massively different. So it turns out that even within the New Testament, the point wasn't to agree. But the point was to celebrate a spectrum of different kinds of good news. So, in other words, people keep saying, oh, when the Council of Nicaea decided what was going to be in the Bible, first thing, wrong, it didn't. And then they say, well, they tried to make everything agree. And that's the really interesting thing, is they don't. I think if you tried to get Paul and Matthew in the same room, it would be a huge argument. So I think, and now with these additional arguments, with these additional documents, I think the one thing that we feel fairly sure of is that it's time to think of early Christianity not as a singular message, but as a cluster of messages. And then socially to say, it looks like as John Dominic Crossan says, from the very beginning, the very time Jesus says a saying, three people hear him differently. If you've got three people listening to Jesus saying a saying, they all run in different directions, and by and large, they experience each of their directions as salvific.
As what?
Salvific, as saving. Any other, as we sort of gently say goodbye to Dan's question for a moment, any other sort of things bubbling about what you are, how you're feeling about this question of how did Christianity begin and what is Christianity? Yes, Karen.
Just a real quick one. I wish they could change the name of it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I still find it difficult to identify as Christian.
I'm so sick of trying
because
to
of all of that word, sort of all the baggage that's around that word.
Amen. Mm-hmm. I know. I'm sorry, I'm just done.
No, that's, both of you, this is really exciting. So, I mean, you may remember that 2 days ago I said the word Christian only is used 3 times in the New Testament. Mm. And in no times is it used at the way we use it. That is, as a religion. So I guess I want to say, really, excuse me, I'm not using the right terms. In other words, it seems to me as if what you two just did was bring two realities together. One is that now Christianity is an extremely disputed term. I mean, it's at the heart of the culture war. And at the beginning, it's a word that didn't seem to matter. In other words, it could be that the content of this and the practice of this was and is meaningful, but that the you two wanting to bail on the word, at the moment it doesn't seem to me like there's if we keep up the important questions and agenda, it doesn't quite matter. In other words, if the word gets in the way, why not? All of these documents, inside and outside the canon, wouldn't mind because they don't know about the term.
But there is something lovely about belonging.
Oh.
Belonging, yeah. Having just a togetherness.
Well, that's like the constant, to me, there's a constant struggle about any kind of label.
Yeah.
Right? It's so comforting to label something, but at the same time so limiting, and also any kind of label has baggage. You know, you label something under the assumption that everyone in the world is going to understand what that label means to you, but they're all going to have their own idea of what that, you know. So that's that's labels to me, that Christian or whatever label you're looking at, you know. There's that, you want it, but you don't want it.
And not to be too specific, but for me, this being my first, just a tiny visit last week, but my first longer visit here, one of the belongings that I see active, and I'm not wanting to idealize Holden, but one of the kind of exciting parts about belonging is there's not a lot of specificity. In other words, I haven't heard a lot of people enjoying their belonging to Holden and then saying, and now let's read the creed of Holden. In other words, people seem to be excited about some differences. So, labels, and I think labels and belonging can be two different things. I'm going to scoot on to Karen's question about sin.
Yay.
It was such a wonderful question. I heard several questions in it. First, I heard you saying how freeing it was to even have that on the table. And then I heard you saying, well, then how do we talk about the damage we do? And that seems, in other words, if the going original sin hypothesis, and just to remind ourselves, original sin is not an idea in the Bible. I mean, the Bible talks a bunch about sin, but it never uses the word original sin. So that the hypothesis of original sin for Christians comes from Genesis, but Jews who've been living with them much longer than we say, it doesn't say original sin. So just that perspective opens up. But then to say, so what is it about us? How do we think about our damaging one another and holding ourselves responsible to one another? I guess I think we could have a week on that.
At least.
But yeah, and actually, so I'm wanting not to say any answer, but say, wouldn't it be great if we had a clean slate to answer your question? And then finally, I think I would want to say about the early Christianity and its diverse take and its enthusiasm about saying things like this, because we found this both in Paul's letter to the Romans and in the Gospel of Mary. It seems to me that at least we can say a lot of people felt like they were hopelessly corrupt and trapped, and then they didn't. But that still leaves your question good and on the table, and why don't we start back talking about it? In other words, what if we had the question about how do we hurt each other and why, and decided just temporarily to observe the Gospel of Mary's taboo one. So what if we spent a week talking about hurting one another and responsibility, but didn't use the word sin? My bet is that we would come up with a bunch of really interesting ideas that weren't less strict, but might make more sense. And then we might just track them back to some of the ways the early Christians talked about sin and no sin. I feel like there was one other question you had about that. Okay. I
feel like we covered it.
Okay, thanks. And then there's Kari and her suspicion. And then we had two suspicions, right? We had suspicion of the Bible and suspicion of the new texts at the same time. Again, there, I actually don't see anything wrong with feeling suspicious in any direction. What I said on Monday was, you know, one of the things that I think is dangerous about these new documents is people like Elaine Pagels, a good friend and a great scholar, are saying, oh, these new documents are way better than the old ones. Mm-hmm. And you know, just for instance, using this Karen's feeling free about the mention of a maternal deity in some of these new documents. I want to say there are a whole bunch of documents that were discovered that are just terribly women-hating.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So in other words, so suspicion on that front seems reasonable. And then the suspicion of the Bible and the New Testament also seems reasonable to me. In other words, there are seven different books of the Bible which say slavery is ordained by God and slaves obey your masters. Well, that's just poison I mean, we can say, oh, well, that was it. Well, that's what we mean. When we say, oh, they believed that, and we don't believe that now, so what we're saying is that that's not very reliable. That doesn't mean that it's not really good news most of the time. For me, suspicion seems to be a help for us in sorting through all of this, but not cynicism. For me, one of the modern killing of the spirit is cynicism. That is that everybody's fooling me all the time. I kind of want there to recommend what I would call an adult approach to life. I mean, so look at our friends and our relatives, whom we mostly love and all of whom have betrayed us. Just because that's true doesn't mean that we don't love them and they don't have value to us. So for me, to think about the New Testament or any of these other documents as good friends or part of the family to which we have loyalty, but since we're, you know, in the developmental scheme, basically when we're little kids, we should have parents whom we think are all-powerful and all-good. We know developmentally, if we trust our parents, and that doesn't happen to all of us, but when we get to trust our parents as all-good and all-powerful for those first 4 or 5 years, it really helps us. And then the child's consciousness, we start noticing, by adolescence, we know that our parents aren't all powerful and all good. Sometimes we think they're no good and have nothing to contribute. But as we grow to an adult, by and large, unless we have a tragic childhood, we can come to a loving relationship in which we claim what we've been given, and we know that they're not trustable on all fronts. So for me, that's a kind of a metaphor, at least, friendship or family for the Bible that adults come to about the rest of the world. So why not claim the Bible and these new documents, or the sloppy mix of them, as friendly, but not without being subject to suspicion. That's a real quick answer to a wonderful set of questions. Any kind of, it feels like there should be someone saying why that doesn't quite work for them.
For me, it works very well. I think it's a really good way to look at it, that as we look at the Bible or have looked at it over a period of time, and for each of us, some study more and some study less, that you come to it as a child, and that your hope is as a child that it's going to be what it says it is, and that as you study it and it becomes richer and more complex, then your responsibility becomes you become more involved in your responsibility to respond to it, I think. Mm-hmm. I loved your analogy, and it makes me want to not be so childlike in my approach to the scripture, and to delve deeper and roll up my sleeves and not be too afraid to get into it further.
And for me, and I know I'm out of time, the way you brought this up, Kari, seemed to me to be most tender and available, in that having suspicion and then having the real experience of reading something that tugged at your soul. Those are not contradictions in approaches that we can both, in other words, thinking and feeling, loving and having reservations belong together. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for all that you brought today. It seemed like it was a way for us to kind of begin to take next steps. And, you know, this is my business. I'm teaching this all the time. So feel free to email me or anything else. We were just planning this afternoon of when I'm coming back. So
thank you.